May it please the Court, I'm Mike Heffernan from the Madison office of Foley and Lardner, appearing on behalf of Virgil Smith. Virgil Smith was a participant in a bank robbery in Fort Wayne, Indiana, in December of 2002. It is undisputed that he was involved in this bank robbery. It is also he does not concede his guilt for aiding and abetting an armed robbery. What is at issue is primarily his guilt or innocence on the second count, which was aiding and abetting a crime of violence in which a firearm was used. And I must admit at the beginning of my argument that I am perfectly aware of the very, very high standard of proof which needs to be met in this case, because the judge's determination, and by the way, this case was tried to the court, rested in large part on credibility determinations. Therefore, I understand that we come to this court with a very, very heavy burden to meet. Basically, the proof that went in against my client was the proof of his three co-conspirators, Melvin Woods, Gernard Freeman, and DeMarcus White, all of whom pleaded guilty to charges arising out of this, and all of whom agreed to testify for the prosecution truthfully as witnesses regarding Mr. Smith. According to the district court, and to the appellee, the inconsistencies in the testimony of these three co-conspirators are tangential or inconsequential because they do not go to the heart of the government's case, which was to prove that Virgil Smith provided the gun, a .45 caliber pistol, that was used in this robbery. There is no doubt. In fact, the judge used the phrase, he said, their testimony is uniform and it is consistent. In regard to all of them putting the blame on Virgil Smith. It is true. It was uniform in their attempt to show that Virgil Smith is the person who should take the blame for providing this gun in this robbery. It is not uniform in all respects, and there are a number of inconsistencies which I believe the court did not give proper weight to and which undercut its determination, its blanket determination, that their testimony was uniform and complete. I will give, and that it did not go to the heart of the matter. I will give one example. Obviously, one of the major issues is whether or not Virgil Smith had access to a .45 caliber pistol. It is the testimony of one of the prosecution witnesses, his co-conspirator Melvin Woods, was that I saw Virgil Smith with a .45 caliber pistol 2 months before the robbery in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Well, 2 months before the robbery, Virgil Smith was not in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He was incarcerated in a prison in the state of California. The other important point besides the inconsistencies of these witnesses is that the judge really gave short shrift to what I believe was the testimony of witnesses for the defense, whose testimony I believe did go to the heart of the matter. One witness testified that she saw Gernard Freeman, one of the co-conspirators who testified against Virgil Smith, with in possession of a .45 caliber pistol 6 to 7 months prior to this robbery. Another witness testified that the day before the robbery she saw Gernard Freeman in possession of a .45 caliber pistol, and another witness testified that the morning before the robbery she saw Gernard Freeman in possession of the .45 caliber pistol. The other point that I would mention briefly before moving on to my second argument is that it's also very interesting in this case that the person who undeniably took the .45 caliber pistol into the bank, who undisputably brandished that weapon during the bank robbery, and who undisputably left the bank with that gun and was the last person seen with the gun, was never apprehended, and the gun has never been recovered at all. This person, Rasheen Childs, never testified. Therefore, my position is that the uniformity of the three co-conspirators in blaming Virgil Smith cannot overshadow the lack of uniformity in their stories, and the lack of uniformity in the overall scope of the witness, which included witnesses for the defense, which I believe the judge did not give proper weight to. However, once again, I close my argument by acknowledging that we have a very heavy burden to meet in this case. The second issue on this appeal, which I will briefly address, is, if I dare say so, an interesting issue, and that is the issue of whether, in determining whether or not a matter should be dismissed with prejudice on speedy trial grounds, whether the time which has been spent after the initial violation of the speedy trial statute, challenging that violation in appeals to this court, in appeals to the United States Supreme Court, and, of course, in the time that the case has been pending up there, should be considered as part of the prejudice which may affect the case when it goes back. I have to admit that, quite frankly, I have been unable to find a case which squarely addresses this issue, or even one which tangentially addresses the issue, quite frankly. What the circuit court did in this case, when it first came back and there was a hearing on the motion to dismiss, is it looked at one of the cases that was cited by the defense, United States versus Taylor, and said, well, in United States versus Taylor, this argument could have been made because there was this long period of appeals after the initial speedy trial violation, and the Supreme Court never addressed that. Yes, the Supreme Court never addressed that issue. I can't tell whether it was ever raised in that case. And at the risk of sounding as if I'm so out in left field, because this is an argument that it does seem to me begs for consideration by this court or someone, it certainly makes sense to me that if, through no fault of the defendant, there is an initial speedy trial violation followed by a lengthy appeal process which ultimately leads to success on appeal, that when you go back to determine whether or not the matter should be dismissed with prejudice, you should consider the impact of that lengthy delay in this case.
Is your argument that that additional time period should be considered on its own in that sort of sense, or that it should be considered to the extent that it makes a difference in how well witnesses remember the events and the, you know, the inability to collect information and evidence and that sort of thing?
Well,
that it should be factored in as a factor standing alone?
I think it should be factored in standing alone. I think that delay is a factor in and of itself, which needs to be factored in. And if you review the case law on this, it basically indicates that the longer you go between when the speedy trial should have been afforded and in fact giving that trial, the harder it is to prove things like prejudice and inability to properly prepare for trial, and that there's a presumption that the delay in and of itself is a factor that should be considered. So my position would be that that you look at the initial delay between for the first violation of the Speedy Trial Act, then you look at how long it took to get there and get back so that you could have a court determination as to whether or not the matter should be dismissed with or without prejudice, that there is a presumption that if you're dealing with a period of multiple years, as in this case over 4 years, that it is prejudicial, and that under those circumstances the burden of the defense to establish prejudice is lessened.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Heffernan. Ms. Lowry?
May it please the court, I'm Leslie Muller Lowry, and I was the trial counsel on the second trial of Virgil Smith. It's the government's position that with regard to count one, with regard to count two, the evidence was sufficient and that a rational trier of fact could have found all of the elements charged beyond a reasonable doubt. there were undisputedly three co-defendants that testified against Virgil Smith on the issue of where the .45 weapon came from. All of them clearly said that the weapon came from Virgil. The inconsistencies highlighted by the defense go to whether Rasheen Childs took it out of the trunk of Jannard Freeman's car himself, or whether it was handed to him by Virgil Smith. Neither one of those are of any import. The fact of the matter is all three were consistent on who provided the .45, how it actually ended up in Rasheen Childs' hand does not affect who gave it to them. With regard to the fact that each of their stories may not have been identical to one another, I think if all three of the co-defendants' stories had been absolutely identical as to what they heard and saw relative to the gun, that in and of itself would have been suspicious. Given three separate witnesses with three separate perspectives, three separate abilities to perceive what was going on or to recall what was going on, the fact that there are these other inconsistencies the government submits does not take away from their credibility as witnesses or the veracity of what they're saying as to the ultimate issue of who had the gun. What this issue did come down to, matter of factly, is in some respects a he said, she said. There are three individuals for the defense that testified to an origin of the .45 different than what the government's witnesses said, and it is a credibility determination. And the district court is in the best position to assess the credibility of the witnesses, either by demeanor or what they say, how they say it. So there isn't, the government submits, or wasn't in this case, any exceedingly improper testimony credited. It was a credibility determination and a determination by the district court that the witness's testimony that on behalf of the government was credible as to the origin of the firearm. With regard to the speedy trial violation, it's the government's position that Virgil Smith was not prejudiced at all by the retrial of this prosecution. Up until the point where Zedner was decided in June of 2006, the law afforded no relief to Virgil Smith on a speedy trial violation. Up until that point, it was a harmless error standard. Zedner came along and said, no, this is an improper standard under which to analyze speedy trial violations. At that point, Virgil Smith then became eligible for some sort of relief on his speedy trial violation. The case was remanded back to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals sent it back to the district court for determination of whether it should be dismissed with or without prejudice. So the proper time frame under which this should be analyzed is the time between when Zedner was decided, which is the point in time where Virgil Smith was afforded some relief, and even at the outside, when the second prosecution even went to trial. That period comes up to a period of 15 months and 22 days between the time he was eligible for relief and the time the second prosecution went forward. In that intervening time, there was no time that was not excludable under the Speedy Trial Act. The trial was tried within the 70 days afforded. And again, there's no prejudice. The same witnesses testified. The same evidence was presented. The testimony was preserved by transcript, so even if somebody wanted to vary off script too far, they couldn't vary too far off script or change their story because they'd be presented with what they said in the first trial. And most importantly, the fact that I think, undercuts Virgil's argument the most with regard to prejudice and his ability to present a defense is that he presented a witness at the second trial that did not present it, who was not presented at the first trial. So it seems to be rather difficult to make an argument that you are prejudiced or somehow hampered in your ability to present a defense because of this intervening period of years, when during that intervening period of years you were able to present another person that was not there in the first time. Additionally, as stated by the district court in its order in 2006, dismissing this without prejudice, it's the government that stands the most to lose by intervening years with regard to a prosecution, because it is the government that bears the burden of proof. So if memories fade, evidence is lost, that tends more often to bear on the government's ability to present its case. For all of these reasons, the government feels and submits to this court that there was ample evidence to support the conviction on the firearms count, and that the dismissal without prejudice on the part of the district court did not amount to an abuse of discretion. We ask that the convictions in this case be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Lowry.